Hello, welcome to The Moment That Made Me, this time.
We put out a mayday on Channel 16, the emergency channel, and nobody answered. The damage control officer is reporting up to 12 different floods, and I've got in my ear the engineer saying, Abbey Wood is suggesting we abandon ship, we're going to capsize.
A catastrophic flood forces a Royal Navy officer to consider desperate measures.
I went to the chart to see if there was somewhere we could deliberately run the ship aground, which is an extraordinary thing, really, when you consider I'd spent my entire career training to avoid doing this. And we looked at the chart and it's called Desolation Island. How we laughed.
The moment that made Tom Sharp happened on the 16th of December, 2008.
I was the second in command of HMS Endurance, but I was in temporary command. The captain was back on, back in the UK. We'd been deployed for 18 months. So I was there to step up. We'd been on patrol in South Georgia, the UK dependency in the South Atlantic, for about 6 weeks, doing our standard work there with the British Antarctic Survey for the Foreign Office, for the UK Hydrographic Office. So we had these various taskmasters, and we'd been in South Georgia for well over a month, and we were off to Valparaiso in northern Chile, which was going to be our break for Christmas and New Year. So we had to do that from South Georgia through Drake's Passage via Antarctica, and we were heading up the west coast of Chile. We had gone into the Magellan Strait that morning to fly. We needed to fly both helicopters to get people off so that they could get home in time for Christmas. I'd gone down to my cabin to make a cup of tea when there was a pipe in the engine room. There was a casualty, and then there was a flood in the engine room. I went up to the bridge, straight up to the bridge to see what was going on. I looked at the cameras to my left, and I saw water coming in at a rate that made me immediately think, if we don't stop this, we're going to sink. We put out a mayday on Channel 16, the emergency channel, and nobody answered because of where we were in the world. And that was the moment I realized that we had to stop this ship from sinking, we had to stop it from capsizing, and we were the only ones that were going to be able to do it.
What was going through your mind at the time?
The very first thing that went through my mind was, what's caused this? It wasn't clear. I didn't think we'd hit something. We used to hit things a lot in an icebreaker. I didn't feel like we'd done that. So I didn't know why this water was coming in. I could see it. It was an extraordinary sight. And for those that were attacking it, the attack party were in there trying to deal with this. Reported later that the noise of the water coming in drowned out the noise of the main engines that were in the same compartment. That was the violence. We took on 1,200 tons in half an hour. That's half an Olympic swimming pool of water came into the ship in half an hour. So my first thought was, what's caused this? And therefore, can we stop it? It's very obvious that we had no pumps or anything that was going to be able to deal with this. We needed to stop it at source. And so that was my first priority, trying to establish what's happened to you.
And what kind of experience could you draw on at that time?
Well, it was very interesting. I turned to my left and saw the cameras and thought, this is really, really serious. We could well sink. I then turned to my right, and the damage control team, the engineer and the logistics officer, were already there, closed up, ready to do their bit. I remember very clearly that the whole team on the bridge stopped talking when I appeared, and they all looked at me, which is a very sort of natural default in a very serious leadership situation. It's deeply uncomfortable if you happen to be the leader. But I remember it really clearly. Now, we hadn't taken the ship to emergency stations at that point, which is a kind of default setting when something like this happens. So I was able to, in the calmest voice I could muster, order the ship to emergency stations, which was great because it elicited a whole series of reactions, one of which was for everyone to stop staring at me and get back to their business. But there right on hand were the two people that I needed. I needed the engineer because I needed to try and find out what had happened. And I needed the logistics officer because she was now in command of the flooding and the developing situation, working out from the scene what's happening and what's our best way to counter that. So the expertise I needed in those first 30 seconds was right there already on the bridge with me.
And what had happened? What had caused the valve to fail?
We were doing some work on a seawater inlet valve. We've been struggling to make enough fresh water for the ship. Now, part of the problem here is that we had almost three times as many people on board as the ship was designed to take. So when you look at the layers that lead up to this incident, it is tempting to get in very much into the detail of who wielded what spanner on the day. But actually, there's a whole legacy of events that lead up to this. But the point is, on this day, we weren't making enough fresh water. And the engineers had gone to clean a strainer on this valve that they had assessed was part of the reason we weren't making enough fresh water. As it turns out, that was incorrect. It was incorrect diagnosis. They shouldn't really have been doing the work on that valve in the way they did it. In fact, it was poorly conducted on many levels. The engineer didn't know they were working on it. I certainly didn't know that we only had one valve that was keeping the seawater out. Normally, that would be a captain's sign-off, but I didn't know it was happening, and neither did the engineer. So essentially, whilst there's this long legacy and list of reasons why we got to that point in time, on the day itself, there was some poor engineering work that went on that led to this incident.
So there you are, the water's pouring in. Your ship is in danger of sinking. Can you talk me through how events unfolded?
Yeah, so once I'd set in train this emergency stations thing, a few things leapt straight to mind. The first and most obvious was that we were going to lose all propulsion. The engine room was filling up. I could see the people in there already up to their knees. And I knew that there's a long bit of the engine room beneath the deck plates they're on. In other words, there's hundreds of tons of water already in the engine space. And because we're a commercial vessel, all the engines are in one compartment. In a warship, they're split deliberately for survivability. But in a commercial ship, they're all in one space. So I knew we would lose propulsion. I reckon we had probably 6 to 10 minutes maximum where we could still drive the ship around. So my immediate thought is, what do I do with the ship? I went to the chart to see if there was somewhere we could deliberately run the ship aground, which is an extraordinary thing, really, when you consider I'd spent my entire career training to avoid doing this. I'm now looking for an opportunity to do it deliberately, because that seemed to me like a good option to stop the ship from sinking. But where we were in the Western Magellan Straits, and it's like Norway, you know, it's vertical. What you see is what you get. So there was nothing. So at that point, my best option is to turn the ship into wind, increase to about 6 knots. I didn't want to go too fast in case this was a gash in the side of the ship, and I still didn't know that. But go to 6 knots and keep one engine running for as long as I can, because I know that as soon as we lose propulsion, the ship will turn beam onto the sea and we'll head back downwind. So we need to buy ourselves as much drifting time as possible. So that was sort of item one. The second one was what to do with the helicopters. We had one that was turning and burning on deck, was about to take off. So we shut that one down, got the flight crew inside the ship. Don't stow the helicopter, because that takes 20 minutes that we don't have. Get the flight crew inside the ship and then get a message to the helicopter that's in Punta that's just lifted off. We don't need, I knew instinctively that 4.5 tons of top weight we weren't going to need. So literally in the first sort of minute, those were my initial thoughts. Get upwind and sort the aviation out. Those are the immediate dangers. And all the while trying to work out what on earth has just happened to the ship.
And how was everyone involved in trying to save the ship? Because I understand you had students on board as well.
Yeah, there were I think two low points in the whole thing. The first was making the Mayday on Channel 16. That was very, very embarrassing. I'd probably been to 100 Mayday calls in my career. And on arrival, there's always an element of maritime buffoonery there, always. Somebody's done something dumb and you're now there to try and fix it. And now it's us doing it. So that was, as a mariner, that was intensely embarrassing, but also essential, you know, so kind of just suppress that and get on with it. The second bit was with the British Schools Exploration Society. We had the 18 to 21-year-olds who had come to us to learn leadership in some deeply ironic fashion. We'd had them with us in South Georgia, and they'd done bits of the Shackleton Walk, and they were a great bunch of kids. But they were now in the wardroom when this was all unfolding, and I had to go and see them to try and explain what was going on. And I saw a lot of fear and a lot of kind of confusion as to how we could be in this situation in a British warship. And I really felt that. And trying to reassure them when at that point in time, I was not reassured, wasn't a huge amount of fun.
And they ended up helping as well.
Yeah, they did. They were brilliant. I have to say, they were all brilliant. One teacher in particular responded less well, but the kids were fantastic. And once we had control of this situation, so we kept them out of harm's way in the wardroom to start with. But once we started to develop a semblance of control, so maybe an hour in, 2 hours in, then yes, we were able to use them in human chains with buckets and bailing out, and they got stuck in just like everyone else. It was kind of hard to see. And I'm still in touch with a few of them now, which is lovely.
At any point, did you actually really think, I'm going to lose this ship?
Yeah, those first 30 seconds, that was my initial reaction. If we don't, when I saw the camera, my first thought was, if we don't stop this, we're going to sink. And there were other moments. I mean, we were getting stability advice from ashore. As the engine room got more and more flooded, and we lost propulsion as predicted, and returned beam onto the sea, we were now rolling very, very violently either side. I mean, we're in an inland waterway, but you may as well be out at sea down there. So we're rolling, and water is coming out of the engine room through these condensation holes that we didn't know were there. So the entire deck above the engine room was flooding simultaneously as the ship rolled. And this water was just appearing. We had to deal with that. I'm getting very gloomy predictions from ashore. We've got communications with the engineers in Abbey Wood. They're doing our stability calculations because our computer is obviously down. And they are predicting that we're going to go into what's called lull, which is an unstable condition, and that there's a very good chance that we will capsize. And in fact, at various points, they were advising. In fact, it felt awfully like telling me to abandon ship. So there were other moments where I'm looking out of the bridge window, I'm seeing the ship flailing around from side to side. I can see from other cameras that the water is through the ship. The damage control officer is reporting up to 12 different floods in different parts of the ship. And I've got in my ear the engineer saying, Abbey Wood is suggesting we abandon ship. We're going to capsize.
And why didn't you?
A couple of reasons. Firstly, I'd spent a lot of time at sea by that point, and I'd spent a lot of time at sea in command of small ships whose job it was to stop in the water. And that sounds sort of slightly trite, but you know, most ships, most warships go quite quickly from A to B and then do their work on the move. But if you're in fishery protection, let's say, which I was, or in Northern Ireland patrol vessel, which I was, you spend a lot of time stopped in the water in very heavy sea states. I mean, years, actually. So I had a very good sense in my mind of what constituted unstable versus stable. So I was sitting there looking out of the window, looking at the wind and the sea state and the conditions, having a feel for the stability condition of the ship and thinking, you know, if I was stupid enough to do this deliberately and stop like this deliberately, this is what we would get. This is this motion that we're suffering whilst very, very uncomfortable is what you would get. So in my mind, we weren't going to capsize. Now, of course, that's a big call because who's to say? The next one could have got us and we could have inverted and then everyone drowned. So, you know, it's a sort of 1-0 proposition, but I was confident. And the other problem I had was how to get off the ship. That was not going to be easy. We had those inflatable tubes that go down the side of it, either side of the ship, and the life rafts inflate at the bottom of them. They look amazing when you test them in harbor, but they're not much use in anything above a sea state 3 or 4, and we were way above that. So how are we going to get into these life rafts? And then even if we do successfully get in, how do we keep ourselves safe once in them? Because there's rocks everywhere, and the wind is going to sweep us down onto the rocks. We've got no engines on these little life rings. So at the water temperature is 1 degree, you fall in that, you've got a survivability of minutes. So it struck me that getting off dry and safe and then staying safe was going to be very nearly impossible. And then I added that to my sort of general sense that we were already in the best life raft we had, and I stayed put.
And thankfully you were right. How did you get out of that situation?
Eventually, there's a couple of sort of layers here. The first was that a ship was coming towards us. A little boat called the MV Pulu was coming towards us. And they were going to arrive in a few hours' time. So my first thought was, if I can get them to take a line through the ship's head and yank the ship's head into wind, there and hold us in position, then that's a very different proposition. We're, at the moment, we've got about 2 hours before we're on the rocks. And incidentally, Northwood, the headquarters called me up and asked for the name of the island we were going to hit. And we looked at the chart and it's called Desolation Island. how we laughed. But this fishing boat, the MV Pudu, by the time they got to us, it was dark. The wind was up to 50 knots. We were thrashing around and they came nowhere near us. They said something in Spanish on the radio and that was the last we saw of them. Now, what that meant, I now had use of the forecastle. I'd kept the forecastle clear so that we could take this tow line. But now that option had gone, I decided to put one of the anchors out to its fullest extent to see if that would at least slow us down. And it didn't. But what it did do was it altered our rate of our angle of drift very slightly, probably only about 5 degrees, but enough to be taking us over a rocky pinnacle at a depth of about 80 meters. So you know, very deep, and a few yards to the west, it dropped down to 500 meters, which of course is way deeper than the anchor. So we then spent a very uncomfortable 90 minutes or so, hoping nothing changed as we headed for this 80 meter contour and hoping that when we got to it, the anchor would hold. And all of that happened. That's exactly what happened. The ship's head started to come into wind, and at first, none of us would believe it. We thought our eyes were playing tricks. But no, the anchor held, and that's where we stayed for the next 24 hours whilst we sorted ourselves out and the salvage tugs.
And the rest is history. Did you manage to stop the flooding, or was it a question of just the people who were coming to salvage you and rescue arriving in time?
Yeah, we were able to control it. Once the engine room was totally full, and that actually only took half an hour, and that's hence 1,200 tons. That's a 1,200-ton compartment flooded in half an hour. And as a little sub-story, I actually sent the diver in to that compartment when it was three quarters full. I was advised that if he could get to this valve, he could manually shut it off. So I got him to the bridge. We had a chat about how to do it and quite frankly, the jeopardy I was putting him in. You know, I was risking his life for this. But he got to this valve and it didn't work. He couldn't shut it. And then he got spun off and disorientated and decided to evacuate the engine room as we were shutting the hatch. So that was, you know, that was fortunate. But the engine room was full. From that moment on, the rate of ingress did slow down. We still had this problem with the rolling ship and the water coming up. We were sitting so low in the water that waves were breaking over the back end and flooding the aft hold. The hatch, the provisions hatch into the aft hold wasn't watertight, or as watertight as we might have hoped. And now we're flooding in the aft hold. And if that floods, then we're definitely going to sink. So we had to contain all of these things. So we didn't necessarily stop the water coming in, but we were able to slow it to a rate where we could manage it using the few portable pumps we had left, bailing, using the hydraulic doors we had on board. We were able to close and shut those and manage the water we had in the ship to keep ourselves vaguely stable. We then sat there for overnight. A cruise liner arrived. So this cruise liner had gone past us earlier in the day, and we had requested that they'd be turned around and come back to us, which they did. Because actually, had we not gone to anchor fortuitously on this pinnacle, they were our next best option. They were due to arrive along, you know, to us at almost exactly the same time we were due to hit the rocks. So I think I probably still would have got everyone off the ship at that point, because you don't want everyone on board with ship smashing up against the rocks. So get everybody off, keep a small crew back, and then try and get the cruise liner to do what I wanted the fishing boat to do and take a line and sort of, you know, hoik us off the rocks, which they would have done, I think. I mean, if you want one type of ship who can operate in very bad weather close to land, it's the cruise industry. They're experts at it. And I was talking to their captain. So they arrived, but by then we were at anchor. So we, like I say, we were already in this much more stable position. So now it was a case of shoring up the inside of the ship. The engine room bulkhead, the aft engine room bulkhead, was bulging ominously because of the weight of water in it. If that had collapsed, then that 1,200 tons of water would have burst through the ship and taken everyone with it. So we had to patch that up. We had to manage the water in the aft hold that had come into the hatch. We had to deal with the many, many floods on the accommodation decks above and try and shut them off. And we were listing quite heavily to port at this point. So We had a lot of internal management to do. Meanwhile, one of the salvage tugs is coming at full speed from Punta Arenas. Punta Arenas is a sort of a charmless town right in the middle of nowhere, and their harbour, as we went into it much later, has 20 of these massive ocean-going salvage tugs waiting to get the call up because they're the only ones down there that can do it. So eventually one of these came to us and took us in tow. There was a little bit of drama involved there, but they got us in tow. And before you know it, we're heading inland. We're in the much calmer waters of the narrow of Magellan. And mm-hmm. we're towed for 24 hours alongside into Punta Arenas.
And the biggest sigh of relief, I bet, of your life. This was the moment that made you. How long was that moment?
I think that probably the bits that sort of made me was that were those first couple of hours, where we were in real, it was real jeopardy. There was a real risk to everyone's life on board that I'm now responsible for, and I couldn't be certain that we could get out of it. So that made me, insofar as I managed to maintain enough self-control to convince everyone around me that I had control of this situation when I patently didn't. And I managed to do that without any sort of false optimism, I think. I never really glamorized any of this. I just kept it to what I could see and what I thought we should do to fix it. So that was reassuring, because until you've tested yourself in that situation or a situation that bad, I mean, I've been in lots of situations that come up, some of them very dicey, because that's the nature of running warships. It's a risky business. So you are used to taking high levels of risk, but this was exceptional.
And incredibly, you were only 36 at the time, Tom. How did that moment make you, and how have you drawn on that experience in later life?
It gave me the confidence to realize that I can tackle pretty much anything. You know, I've got the basic skill set to be able to lead and tackle extreme situations. When I went to my frigate after this, so I went and commanded the frigate after the icebreaker. I actually had to be slightly careful to almost sort of park it. I didn't want it to define me in that job. I didn't want to suddenly become a risk-averse captain. I didn't want to give my engineering officer a hard time for fear of this happening again. I wanted to let them run their business, and I wanted to carry on being, you know, sort of the CEO that I was. So in a way, I had to suppress it a little bit. But thereafter, you know, it was just tremendously reassuring to know that I had that in my toolbox, the ability to deal with extreme jeopardy and manage it in a fairly sort of controlled manner.
And it wasn't the end, though. When you were safe, there was an investigation.
Yeah, in some ways, actually, the aftermath was perhaps more difficult because it went on for so long. The investigation started the day after we got alongside. We're still in Punta Arenas. The captain was flown back. I had to have some, you know, fairly interesting conversations with him. But now we were in recovery mode. Let's get the ship safe. Let's get the water out. The system ashore is working out what the prospects for the ship are. That came down the line a wee bit. Initially, investigation started, and it started the next day. And it went on for about a year. So it wasn't just one investigation. We had four in a row, from the sort of initial one to the technical one to see who did what to the valve. Then we had a senior officer-led service inquiry that was really going to get to the bottom of this. And then the police were called in. Now the police were the only people with the sort of authority to actually apportion blame. But that was nearly a year after the event. Meanwhile, people in my team and me were being put consistently through the ringer, constantly asked, you know, who did what, asked questions. And for those who held themselves partially responsible for this incident, you know, they found that very tough. And so from a leadership perspective, for me, I found it, you know, almost as difficult, because, and particularly when we got back to Portsmouth, by now I'm in full command. The captain's been reassigned. I'm now in full command. But, you know, we had a broken ship with no real hope, no real prospect. A few people who were struggling a wee bit. And this entire machine moving around us. And my job was to remind that machine that there were still humans at the end of this. humans who had done some pretty extraordinary things in that 48-hour period. But that was a struggle, because you're now just a very small voice in a very large system. And that I thought was, yeah, that was difficult.
And what has this experience done to you as a person? What kind of person has it made you?
Well, that's a tricky one to answer. I mean, I hope it hasn't changed me, because I think the fundamentals of me as a leader, as a naval leader, but as a leader generally, were I think already in place. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, but the system perhaps would endorse that, because I then, had driven 4 different ships at different times. So all it did really was sort of confirm to me that I'm in the right place. I can get teams to work with me and not just for me. And so all I made sure from then on, in whatever environment, whether it was a warship or in joint headquarters or in the commercial sector where I now am, that those basics remain the same. The basics of leadership, of empathy and listening, they remain unchanged, whether you're in a flooding ship or whether you're running a small communications campaign in the Middle East. The basics are the same. And I think, that day, those 48 hours, subsequent weeks and months, just really reaffirmed that, and gave me the confidence that the way I'm doing it is about right. It's not perfect, of course, but it's about right.
And Tom, you said that you're still in contact with some of the students who were on board. How do they recall it?
Very interestingly, I mean, one couple then subsequently got engaged and are now married with children. I mean, they have extraordinarily fond memories of it. I think
really.
The human ability to sort of, compartmentalize shouldn't be underestimated. I remember trying to find pictures. We had a photographer on board who I tasked very early on to start taking photos. I mean, within the first half an hour, I knew this record would be important. And of course, if we capsized, it might be the only record we had. So they were taking photos around the ship. And it was extraordinary trying to find pictures of people dealing with this, sailors dealing with this incident that weren't grinning, was absolutely extraordinary. And the first half an hour, we're in real trouble, and this could be very, very serious. But for the sort of, from hours 2 to 36, it's just people coping the way the military does, with this sort of gallows humor. And I think the British Schools Exploration Society, they dealt with it in the same way. And then afterwards, alive and on dry land, very quickly created this sort of a sense of adventure that it had been. You forget the moments where you go, well, are we going to die here? Very quickly. And you move back to the bits that you did that were positive. And so it's kind of reassuring. But that's not to, that's not to diminish the couple that have struggled and are still struggling, because it's a fine line. And it can go one of two ways very, very quickly.
Thankfully, you never, ever got to Desolation Island, Tom. What lessons do you think there are for all of us in this experience?
I mean, the basic leadership lessons are you've got to know your people. You've got to know them intimately so that you can predict who's going to respond well, who isn't going to respond well, and react to both. I mean, classically, we had a couple of people come out of nowhere who just aced it. And one or two of them weren't necessarily the ones you'd expect. So there's a real sense of kind of knowing your team, and they know you and they trust you. So when you say do this, then even if it doesn't make sense where they're standing, they'll do it because they believe in you. So the basics of sort of EQ mixed with a bit of IQ in terms of in leadership terms, I think, are fundamental. I think the other real lesson from this as a leader is the requirement for you to break the chain. And I did that in a number of cases where I could see sub-situations developing during the incident. And I stepped in to stop it. And that is definitely your job as a leader. You need to step back. You need to stay out of the detail. I could hear the damage control team, working at 1,000 miles an hour on the bridge. It would be very tempting to have got involved in that. But that would have been a mistake. I'd have got in the way, And it would have distracted me from my job, which was to explicitly keep clear of that detail so that I could make the big calls. The executive warrant officer, the sort of senior non-commissioned guy on board, came up to me in the pub afterwards and said, you know, the thing you did really well, sir, was you did nothing brilliantly. That was his way of saying, once I had established that he wasn't, you know, that was his way of saying, you didn't get in people's business. You let them do their job, and you only got involved when you felt that you needed to, which was nice. And again, I think that's basic, because as I say, there were a couple of instances where we were about to get ourselves into a bit of trouble, or someone was going to get hurt, and I was able to intervene at that point and go, okay, right, everyone stop. And I think holistically, had we been perhaps a little bit more proactive in the 18 months prior to the incident, perhaps if we'd been a little bit more interventionalist then maybe, and this is a very easy thing to say with hindsight, that maybe we could have stopped the flood in toto. I don't know, and that's almost a ridiculous thing to say, but I do, you know, breaking the chain as a leader is a fundamental part.
Does it revisit you, Tom? Do you dream about this?
No, I don't. I don't. I'm very fortunate in that respect. Not at all. I take tremendous positives from it. I mean, I said it fairly early on, and I think people thought it was a little bit callous, but the ship didn't sink and no one died. So frankly, thereafter, game on. You know, if the investigation wants to give me a hard time for putting the diver in the engine room, which they did, and I was under caution for that, et cetera, then that's fine. That's their job. Because the alternatives to both of those were really much, much worse. I mean, it's still extraordinary to me that no one died. We came so close on a number of occasions, and they were just saved by bravery and a little bit of luck. If the ship had capsized, then everyone would have died. So I compartmentalize it by weighing it against those alternatives, a sinking ship or a capsizing ship. Neither of those happened. So, you know, and me, with the help of 100 of my finest ship's company, got the thing safely alongside, and we were in the pub that evening swapping stories, nicking each other's stories to make ours sound better, you know. And before you know it, at that point in time, the likelihood of me getting any sort of post-traumatic stress, in my view, was zero. And that's the way it's played out. But you know, I regard myself as lucky in that respect, because that's not been the case for everyone.
Tom Sharp, it's been such a privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us and in so much detail.
Thank you.